we are familiar with that tradition, but in the Roman-speaking countries in France and Italy, to some extent also in Switzerland, where I grew up, we have the tradition that you look at literature from whichever country and you compare them, even though maybe they don't have an obvious connection. But by comparing different works of literature and asking relevant questions, you will find out more about these works of literature. So it's not that Tolkien maybe knew Alfieri, but they obviously, being authors, being poets, they share some interests, general human interests, in literature and in questions asked by literature. And so we thought it's an interesting insight also into maybe a tradition that is no longer so vital in the Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-American academic tradition. And so this is, I think, also a contribution that the Eist makes in the translation to this kind of intercultural dialogue among Tolkien scholars. It's not the first kind of publication by Eist. We have some other publications, like you could read it, La Falce.
La Falce Spezzata.
Yeah, and Gero una volta lo obit, stuff like that. And actually some of them have been translated before, also by Roberto Arduino and Claudio Testi, Tolkien and Philosophy. Claudio especially liked the pink cover, as a story to that. And The Broken Side, Death and Immortality in the Works of Tolkien. And of course Claudio's The Pagan Saints of Middle-earth. They all go back to publications originally in Italian, which then were revised and translated and edited by Walking Tree Publishers. And so Tolkien and the Classics is, you could say, the fourth volume in this tradition. And I think it's important that we not only have scholarship in English-speaking worlds, in English-speaking kind of cultures, but it's important that we translate and we get to know also what is going on in other countries, in other languages, other cultures. And of course, we all read English. So maybe not Polish, maybe not so much Italian or so. So it's important that we get to know that in translation. Okay, so that was my bit. Thank you very much. And I hand over to Thomas. Come.
I entirely agree with Thomas there, and as he was talking I just remembered that my first academic article was actually called, was published in Comparative Literature, and it was called Listening to the Nightingale, which was a straight translation of Italian, Udendo cantare lo signorolo. So I entirely agree about the importance of comparing traditions and seeing them as working off each other, which they obviously have for the last, the last couple of thousand years. Well, having said that, that was an aside. I didn't mean to say that, it just came up. But I'm not going to repeat myself, because I've said this before, but I don't think Claudio and Thomas heard it, so I'll say it again very quickly. You know, I make a habit of collecting stupid remarks about Tolkien, and I still think that arguably the stupidest was the guy who said that Tolkien was half-educated. Now, the person who said Tolkien was half-educated was the guru of my time at Cambridge, where I spent 3 years as an undergraduate learning, as far as I can remember, nothing, or at least nothing from my teacher, with one exception. The one course of lectures which I actually followed from start to finish was actually the last course by C.S. Lewis. His lectures on Spencer were very informative and very well delivered. So, but apart from that, well, I'll tell you actually, the other great guru of my time was F.R. Leavis, who wrote the book called The Great Tradition. And this was what everybody was supposed to know about. And since I was young and naive, I turned up to listen to F.R. Leavis, and I listened to the lecture, and it was so bad, I thought, must have been something wrong with my hearing. So next time he lectured, which was the next week, I was there in the front row, in the middle of the front row, with my notebook out, all ready to write down the words of wisdom. And not only was it just as bad as the first lecture, it was the same lecture. He just said the same thing over and over again. Well, that was really what you might call not a great breadth of vision. And that was the trouble with Cambridge in my time. We were told there was the great tradition, and it was the tradition. There weren't any others. Nothing else was important. If you didn't realize that this was the great tradition, then you were half educated. They really meant that. And of course, I need hardly say that it was all not only in English, it was all in modern English. There wasn't anything else of any importance. Well, I have actually written about this. It drove me into a kind of depression. It was like chewing the same piece of chewing gum over and over again. There comes a time when there is no savour left in it. And I was saved from this, I think, by the tradition of comparative literature. I just went and read things in other languages, and that's what kept me going. Well, I should also say, and now I'm back on my proper subject, that this view about the great monolingual tradition was a contradiction of everything that Tolkien believed, as we can now see, in fact, from the collection Tolkien and the Classics. It contains, as Cardio has just said, 21 essays, and it sets Tolkien in the traditions of the Classics, the Middle Ages, and the Modern Period. Now, I can't mention all the essays because there's 21 of them, but looking at the section on the Classics, I'd just like to say that by the time Tolkien left school as a teenager, and of course the school was down the road, King Edward School, his Latin and Greek were quite good enough to get him a master's degree at a modern university, because standards have fallen. Fallen a long way, actually. I got a very low level pass in Latin 60 years ago, actually, and I found myself correcting someone with a master's degree in classical studies from Durham, because if you would believe it, he had confused a gerundive with a past participle. that's what I thought too. After I pointed this out, he did actually, to be fair, write to me and say he blushed with shame when he saw that. So he wasn't all bad. Nevertheless, the section on classics here does show very much what Tolkien had available to him. I was especially pleased in this section to see the essay by Leonardo Mantovani, my former collaborator, Leonardo from Mantua, on Apollonius of Rhodes. Tolkien doesn't mention Apollonius of Rhodes, but we know he bought and he owned William Morris's rendering of Apollonius's Argo Nautica. And I'm quite sure that the first thing Tolkien would have done would have been to go back and see what the Greek looked like. So, Leonardo argues furthermore that this late epic had a considerable influence on Tolkien's creation of a new style hero, a gentler and more patient type than the archaic and savage heroes of Homer. In the medieval section, we can be quite sure that Tolkien was aware of Aquinas and Dante, and his relationship to them are commented on by Claudio Testi and Chiara Bertoglio, respectively. But among the surprises is an essay by another of my former collaborators, Valerie Morisi, and she writes on, I'd never thought of this, but you haven't either, Tolkien and the travels of Marco Polo. Well, you want a great there and back again voyage? That's it, isn't it? So, this has parallels to Bilbo, as Jason the Argonaut has parallels with Frodo. The longest section on Tolkien and the modern period is even more full of surprises. If you'd asked me to write a list of people that Tolkien in the modern period had some connection with, I could have guessed it's Shakespeare. All right, and Luisa Paglieri's essay is called Debtor Against His Will, because I'm quite sure that what Tolkien thought about Shakespeare was that Shakespeare, he could have been good, but you know what happened? Instead of staying here in the West Midlands, where things were done right,
between them.
He went down to London and he got commercial, and there you are, all those things happened. Henry the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and whatever. Anyway, pity about that. He could have done better. Midsummer Night's Dream, fairy play. That was good. The Tempest, fairy play. That was good. What about the others? Anyway, Louisa tells you what to think about that. So I'd have guessed it's Shakespeare, but Walter Scott never crossed my mind. Edgar Allan Poe, ditto. And the Italian authors, Alfieri and Manzoni. Sarah Giannotto points out how well Fëanor fits the Alfierian definition of tragedy. He follows his own destiny with no concern for the conseguenze collettive. Exactly right. It's individualism taken to disaster is all I can say. As for Andrea Mondo on Manzoni, I can only say that I have long had a copy of I Promessi Sposi, and now I really will have to read it. Among the English authors considered, Simone Bonetti considers Tolkien and the war poets, and this brings Tolkien into the context of his close contemporaries, whom one might well call the anti-war poets. He took a very different turning from any of them, but we can see he started from the same place and the same experiences. And then there are the children's classics of his time, like Peter Pan, which impressed Tolkien very much and is commented on by Chiara Nerotti, and The Wind in the Willows, which ends with a homecoming, actually not just a homecoming, if you remember the end of The Willows, it ends with what in Old Norse would be called harmsökn, an attack on the home, which incidentally survives into modern English, though the word is rarely used, as heimsökn. Heimsökn is actually a legal term in Scotland and is taken very seriously. It's really kind of breaking into a house by violence, robbery with violence and breaking and entering. Anyway, The Wind in the Willows, we can see, ends with something very like the scouring of the Shire, as explained by Cecilia Barella. And then, actually, there's another one about which I wasn't expecting, and which I still know nothing because I haven't read the basic text. But actually, this is I've lost it for the moment, but I'll find it. It's actually Giampaolo, who's over there, Giampaolo Canzonieri's The Hobbit and the Puppet, which compares the success of The Hobbit with the strange success of The Adventures of Pinocchio. Well, there's a thought which I hadn't had before. So there are a great many essays here. I apologize to the 11 authors I haven't mentioned, though I have managed to mention 10, but all I can say is the volume is stuffed with new comparisons and new insights. And it reminds us, as I've been saying, that Tolkien was part of a very much greater tradition than the little corner that they taught in my day in Cambridge. And I'd just like to add that this is one of many precious works created by the Associazione Italiana Studi Tolkieniani, of which I now have the button, including Claudio, the slide's gone off, Claudio on the Broken Side, Death and Immortality in Tolkien, and Claudio and Roberto again on Pagan Saints in Tolkien, and I think one that Claudio didn't mention, the collection by Stefano Giorgiani on Tolkien and War, La Generazione Perduta, The Lost Generation. Well, all I have to say then, and that's what I've been saying, is that for all his English patriotism, Tolkien is a possession for the world, and not just for England. And the Associazione is busily and fruitfully reminding us of that fact.